Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Back Issue Spotlight. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host.
And I'm Bob Breitel. In this episode, we'll be discussing a wide variety of back issues that John and I have recently acquired or read, as well as a spotlight on a classic comic storyline.
Joining us this episode is Brian Christman. You may have heard his voice a time or two before. You're on this small little startup podcast. Brian, tell us a little about it.
Yes, it's just a bunch of guys. We're just trying to break into podcasting. We call ourselves Comic Geek Speak, and it's really fun. We've been heard a few times, I think. We had a few listeners out there. You guys listen to the show every now and then, right?
Every once in a while.
Anyway, it's good, glad to talk to you guys.
Cool.
And Brian goes by the nickname of Pants, but we'll be calling him Brian here on the show tonight.
So, Bob, you're a horrible influence. I've picked up quite a few back issues lately, most of them through mycomicshop.com. You know how you were talking about the Dial H run for House of Mystery?
Yep.
I went and bought the whole run.
So you completed yours too.
Yeah. Seeing whereas I had none to start with, I completed it all, lock, stock, and barrel. Very convenient that way, actually.
Yep.
That was House of Mystery 156 to 173. And then the other thing I got on that same order is I ordered Nova 1 through 25 of the 1970 series, because the new series has kind of gotten me reinterested in the character, and I want to go read all that. But they didn't have issues 5 and 8 in the grade I wanted, so they kind of canceled that part of the order, but sent the rest. So I've, of course, put in another order with them to get those and a few other things. But I'll talk about those when I get the rest of that order, which isn't too much. But that's another 40 or 50 comics to go in my to-read pile of back issues, which is overgrowing three drawer boxes at the moment. So how about you, Bob? What all did you get this time around?
Quite a lot. I'm not going to go into excruciating detail. The only old comic of note that I got was Strange Tales number 135, which actually completes my Nick Fury run. So that was the very first appearance of Nick Fury, and it was the only Nick Fury appearance in Strange Tales I didn't have. That'll allow me to segue really quickly into an update on online store Newcadia.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'd actually originally ordered that through Newcadia, and they were having a sale, and it was advertised as being in very good condition. And when I got it, it had a really ridiculous spine roll. I mean, it was like almost a crisp 90-degree spine roll and a lot of folds and creases on the cover. And it's not something I would have called very good on any day. And there were several other books in the order that I got in very good condition that I just didn't think were very good. And there were some that were fine that were maybe very good. So basically, I sent them all back, and they gave me a refund. And in fact, they gave me a refund for postage also, but it kind of threw me back to like the reason I kind of cooled off on using Newcadia previously, and that is down in the very good and fine grades, they tend to be a little generous with themselves on how they grade those comics. So if you collect down in very good and fine, I would caution you against Newcadia, but you can certainly go try it out and see what your luck is like. Very fine, near mint, those kind of books, I've never had a problem with Newcadia, but down in the very good and fine, I'm finding about 50% of the books I have a problem with the way they've graded them. And that virtually never happens with mycomicshop.com. So what I did was I ended up sending Strange Tales 135 back to Newcadia, got my refund, and then I placed an order with mycomicshop.com for the exact same book. It came. It was advertised as very good, beautiful. I would consider it a nice, solid upper end of the very good range. And my comic shop kind of goes the other direction, where they're a little generous in your favor on the grading, which I think does them very well, because that way they don't have to worry about people returning lots of stuff and, you know, ill will and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, enough about that thing. I also have Brian Deemer to blame for telling me about Library Binding Company, and John Mayo a little bit too. John, you pointed out to me that Marvel Saga, the black and white reprint that's in this month's previews.
Yeah.
And I figured, man, before I, you know, if I'm going to go pay $17 or something for a black and white reprint, I could probably find all those issues, you know, in 50-cent bins or something like that. And that's what exactly I did. I checked at a local place that had 50-cent bins, found about half the issues, got the other half of them for, you know, about, I think about 84 cents a piece from mycomicshop.com. I got the entire 25-issue run. I'll be sending that off to Library Binding Company to get those bound into a nice hardcover. And while I was at it, I decided to get some hardcovers made of three of my favorite cross-gen runs. Again, when I was looking for the Marvel sagas in the 50-cent bins, I was able to pick up almost complete runs of Meridian, Mystic, Scion, and Sojourn for 50 cents a book. So I picked up duplicates of all those because I don't like to get hardcovers made of my only copy of a comic, so I'll get extras. So I got almost the whole runs, and then again, by judicious use of mycomicshop.com, Newcadia, and the new Torpedo comics, I was able to complete the runs of those series for, you know, augmenting my 50-cent bin purchases with about maybe the 85 to a dollar and a quarter range per book. And so now I got complete runs, except I'm missing a couple of Sojourns, but I've finished Mystic, I finished Scion, maybe two books away from completing Meridian and about five books away from completing Sojourn. So I'll kind of be poking around looking for those over the next months, but I'm going to send those off and get some nice hardcovers made of them. Then one other thing is, you know, we've been really getting into Robert Kirkman lately. You know, we talk about it on the Weekly Comic Spotlight. You know, we talk about The Astounding Wolfman. We've talked about Walking Dead. John, you turned me on to Brit, and I started reading that, and I really liked it. Well, I was poking around, and I found there were some other books Robert Kirkman had written. So again, while I was making these orders anyway at these various places and looking in the 50-cent bins and dollar bins, I found that he had done Tech Jacket. He had done a series called Tales of the Realm from CrossGen, and he had done a series called Capes, also from Image. And I was able to pick up complete runs of all three of those for probably an average of maybe about 75 cents a book.
Oh, that's a good price. Tales of the Realm, I really enjoyed. Tech Jacket was good. And Capes, yeah, those are good picks.
So, you know, just interesting stuff, you know, and a lot of those books are just not hard to find. And that kind of segues me into just giving a little, the new online comic store out there is called Torpedo Comics. So I checked them out. One thing I noticed about them is that they're really, most of their books, at least the cheap ones, are mostly 90s and 2000s. You know, there's not a whole lot of old vintage books there. They have a lot of CGC graded comics that are relatively pricey. So if you're into that sort of thing, you can check that out there. I don't like to pay inflated prices for CGC graded books, so I kind of stay away from that. But they had a decent amount. You know, I was able to fill in some holes of things that I needed to get that I couldn't find anywhere else, of some Meridian and Sojourn and things like that for a buck a piece. And I got some of the issues of Tech Jacket and Tales of the Realm and, you know, things like that that I needed to complete those off. And I did a nice order with them. But the only thing that kind of bugged me a little bit about them was that they don't have any free shipping option. Most of the other online stores, you can get free shipping if you spend a certain amount of money. And the other thing is the only shipping option that they do have is FedEx. You can get FedEx Ground, FedEx Next Day, or FedEx Priority. You know, and obviously FedEx Ground's the cheapest one. It ended up being $9.20. But, you know, since most of the books I really wanted to get them and I had already spent, you know, like an hour browsing around on their website, I said, okay, I'm going to bite the bullet and just put in the order anyway, get them sent to me via FedEx. But it really made the dollar books that I bought come out to actually be costing me about a buck and a quarter because of the shipping that got added in. Still, you know, a dollar and a quarter for a book that originally was $3. It's not that bad of a deal, but just kind of the principle of the thing. And the other thing I noticed is that their search function absolutely sucks. It's terrible. So, but they're a new place and I'm sure they'll be fixing it up. So if they tweaked their business model a little bit. They also say on their site that they've got hundreds of thousands of comics that they haven't managed to get entered into the system, so they show up online. And they got some pictures of this huge warehouse they got. Looks like it's something out of Indiana Jones with like long boxes on these giant metal pallets that go, you know, 20 feet high or something. It's ridiculous the number of stock they've got. So I suspect maybe give them, you know, a year or so and they could actually turn into something decent. You know, maybe they'll get somebody to fix up the search function once they, you know, figure that out, that that's pissing people off who are coming to their site. And they'll maybe also clue into the fact that all of their major competition, Newcadia, Mile High, and My Comic Shop, all offer free shipping at various price points, so that they're at a definite disadvantage in that. So I would tend personally to not order from them again until they make those kind of enhancements to the site. But, you know, they are a decent, especially if you're looking for books from the 90s and the 2000s, they've got a bunch of stuff out there. And they've got books there that for a dollar that other sites don't have for a dollar.
I checked out the site, and I agree, the search function was very unimpressive. I found it very frustrating to use, to be honest. I couldn't find anything I wanted. And part of that may be they just hadn't entered in all the stock, but part of it is stuff that I thought should have returned some results, returned nothing. So, yeah, I hope that they improve that, and certainly if they do, somebody should let me know, and maybe I'll throw some money that way.
I just looked at all 219 pages of their 99-cent books. I just paged through them. It was on Sunday, and I was just kind of like hanging around. So I just browsed through all 219 pages, and it is the case that there are certain books that you would expect to be in there that just aren't in there at all. So it might, you know, but on the other hand, they had huge runs of like Batman, Captain America, you know, some key books, mostly from the early part of the alphabet. There's only smatterings from, you know, I think A and B, really solid. There's lots of stuff, and then just smatterings of stuff. It looks like they're working their way through the alphabet, putting stuff in. But some of the books I found, things that I just never bought, you know, they're like the Hulk and versus the Darkness, Batman versus the Darkness, some of these Image crossovers that had relatively high cover prices, you know, like $4.99 or something. They're like a buck. And I never bought them when they first came out. So I'm like, what the heck? I'll get them. You know, I got Vampirella versus the Darkness and just wonky things. And in fact, what I found interesting was some of them, they even had variant covers of some of these books that I was looking on mycomicshop.com at the same time. They'd have a book that mycomicshop.com had for like $8 or $9, and it was in their dollar bin.
Wow.
So, you know, there are some hidden gems in there.
Yeah, well, hopefully once they get the search function improved and certainly their entire inventory in that database, that looks like it could be another really good site to go to. I just think it's a little early at this point.
Yeah, agreed.
One thing on the free shipping, I was mentioning how two issues of Nova kind of got canceled on me from My Comic Shop because they didn't have them in the condition I wanted. I wound up placing an order for those in the next lower condition and a bunch of other stuff to just hit that $50 mark for the free shipping. And sure enough, one of those items they either didn't have in stock or didn't have in the right grade, whatever. So it got canceled, which knocked my order below the $50 free shipping mark. But it looks like I'm still getting the free shipping.
I've had that happen before at My Comic Shop. If an out-of-stock book knocks you below the threshold, they will still give you free shipping.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I've had Mile High Comics, same exact thing. I've had myself knocked below the $40 threshold, and then they've gone ahead and charged me like $6 for shipping.
Wow.
So when I order from Mile High, I always put a condition in that little box, and I say, because Mile High actually lets you alter your orders.
Yeah.
And I make a condition. I say, if any out-of-stock item drops me below $40 and I'm not going to get free shipping, cancel the entire order.
That's the one thing I think My Comic Shop still needs to improve on, is if they can pause the entire order to tell you, hey, these two items or three items or whatever aren't available. I'm puzzled why they don't have a tell us yes, you would like it in these other grades that we have available. Why aren't they trying to not so much upsell me, but at least give me the option of still giving them money in that order?
Yeah, they're extremely inflexible on making any change. You can't make any change whatsoever to an order after it's placed, short of just canceling the entire order.
Yeah, and I'm sure they're banking on the fact that if you've got a couple of things that they don't have in, but they have another grade, you'll just place another order and hit that $50 mark or whatever.
But at least, even if you drop below it, they're not going to all of a sudden charge you shipping. They still give you the free shipping.
Yeah.
So that's nice.
So that's still my kind of go-to place for online stuff at the moment.
So we've been going on, Brian. What about you? Have you got any, you have any back issues of note that you've picked up recently?
I got one off of eBay. I got a Detective I needed from the 50s. I got Detective 263. I usually shoot for the reader copy grade, but even in that range was about $30, which is about my limit for that age of books. But beyond that, the last ones I got was at the Wild Pig sale where I mentioned I got a few books for you there, Bob. Hope you got those okay.
I did. Thank you very much.
All right.
Finished me off on my Superman family.
Yep. But at Wild Pig, they had a lot of dollar books which were half off. Actually, the whole store was half off. So I got a lot of things to fill in runs, like Legion of Superheroes from the 70s with Superboy, got a couple of World's Finest issues, and the one old issue I got was Detective 265. So again, that sort of filled my old Detective run. That was, again, $30. So that was, I try to get one or two issues when I go to these sales from the old end of my list, my want needs, and got a lot of cheap books sort of balance out the price altogether.
Cool. Sounds good. Do you do much online with any of these retailers, or do you just do most of your back issue stuff in person?
Most of it is in person. I do keep up with Mile High when they have their code word sales, and I usually will go there for things I just can't find anywhere else. And usually with them, I go with the lowest grades because I'm in the reader copies, so I get a lot of books really cheap when they have those sales. I have done some things with my comic shop. I've done a few things with them, not as much as Mile High, and very rarely eBay. Mostly what I do is I hit the sales at the stores, local, and of course, the conventions. I just go crazy at the conventions.
And which we'll be talking about in a second. One thing I would just tell you is that since you are buying in the reader copy range, mycomicshop.com, the books look phenomenally nicer in those reader copy grades than
Mile High
Comics. And that's one of the reasons I did my major shift from Mile High. I used to buy tons of stuff from Mile High, and I went over to My Comic Shop just because in the good, very good, and fine conditions, they use strict Overstreet. And again, mm-hmm. they're a little generous in your favor on those. Whereas Mile High, they've got a homebrew grading system, that Chuck Rosansky system, that allows a lot more creases and tears and whatnot in the lower grades. And again, Newcadia, I don't recommend them in the lower grades either. Their grading standards are very flimsy.
Okay.
Well, shall we go ahead and talk about buying back issues at conventions?
Sure.
Sure.
Do you wanna talk first, John, about, we were gonna talk about the distinction between the different kinds of cons?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. For my money, there's really three categories of conventions. There's the huge ones, the national level that people travel cross country for, the San Diego's, the Chicago, the New York one, I think's at that size now. I mean, the Wizard World type stuff, but really, there's less than a dozen of these. On the far end of the spectrum, you've got kind of the local city-level conventions, if you will, that people might go to the next city over for. And this is more just kind of a gathering of the local retailers and people who do the shows there. And then there's kind of that mid-level regional one that people might go a state or two away, maybe three or four states, depending on the part of the country and how far, but not something that's going to have a huge draw from, you know, it's like, wow, I'm going to travel cross-country for that show, because they're just not quite there. And typically, at the upper level, you've got a convention that has not only just the dealer's room, but a heavy programming track, where you can see movies, you can hear from creators, there are autographs to be had, and it's just a whole big production, and there's things that even if you're not interested in buying comics, there's tons to do. I mean, San Diego takes that to a whole new level in many respects, with a dozen or two tracks going on concurrently. Whereas, of course, at the local level, you have almost none of that. If you have a big-name person, that's kind of a surprise. And then there's that, again, that middle level, which sometimes will have programming, sometimes won't. Oftentimes, they'll have a half a dozen, you know, celebrities, either of movie or comic book or combination thereof. And I think at each of these different types of conventions, you're liable to find different types of back issues. And depending what you're looking for, the price you're willing to pay, sometimes you almost need to go to those national level conventions. Other times, that's going to be the worst place possible for you to find what you're looking for. So did you have anything to add on kind of the delineations of conventions, Bob?
Not actually. I think you did a really good job of detailing them there. What about you, Brian?
That's pretty accurate. You have your San Diegos, your mid-levels, and your cities. That's a very good starting point.
So do you want to start big and go down or start small and go up?
Let's let our guests decide.
Well, let's start small, because I've had a recent experience at a small convention.
Okay, let's start with that then.
Okay, there's a town about 45 minutes from where I am here in Reading. There's an Allentown convention, and I was there a few weeks ago. And like you said, it's a small local gathering, a lot of local dealers. This one had maybe 10 dealers. It's a small room. The dealers, of course, know everybody, and it was a nice atmosphere. And the one I went to, like I said, it was about a month or two ago. There was actually a really good selection of books there, much to my surprise. It was my first time there in quite a long time. The first spot I went to was the cheap books, the dollar books, and found a lot there. But much to my surprise, there was about two or three dealers who had some really good, you know, Silver Age DC and Marvel books, and, you know, in really good condition, which really surprised me. I didn't expect to see that at such a small con. Usually go to your bigger cons, you'll see that type of thing. But you can find some gems at some of these smaller shows. And like you said, it was only a town or two over, about a 45-minute drive. So it was an easy afternoon, and it was a really, really good experience. So don't discount these small local run shows, whether they're at a hotel or at a small strip mall, which this one was. You can really find some good deals there.
I would almost say these days that's one of the best places to go look for back issues. Now, it's obviously going to vary from convention to convention, region to region and stuff, or city to city, really. But because these are such local conventions, this is where the stores are going to take their excess inventory, the things they haven't been able to move in their store, and try to move them at the show. And certainly for the lower price books, certainly for the dollar bin, quarter bin type stuff, this is probably the best place to go look for these things. Now, it's been a while since I've really gone to this level of convention, just because in the town I'm in, there's not many local conventions, and the ones that there are, there's like Staple, which is a small press convention. And when I say small press, I mean fairly small press, which is fine and great, but that's not where my interests lie. And there aren't that many retailers and dealers here that I'm aware of dealing in the back issue stuff. So the time or two I've gone, I wasn't really finding stuff that I was looking for. But most of what I'm looking for is going to be, you know, late 70s or earlier, whereas a lot of these places just aren't going to have it. But back when I was in the San Diego area, I'd go up to the one up in your neck of the woods, actually, Bob, at the Shriner Auditorium or whatever in L.A., and some of the stuff I found there was just great. So, you know, obviously the bigger the city you're in, the more dealers and retailers are going to be around you. But, you know, certainly it's definitely worth checking out, and, you know, it's hit or miss. But when you hit, my God, you can find an entire run of stuff you're looking for at just incredibly good prices.
Yeah, I guess I have similar observation. I think the Shrine has been superseded by the Frankensun show that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
In the LA area as like the main regular little local show. I mean, that happens weekly. But the difference is that since there's so much less overhead than at the big conventions for the dealer, they can offer better deals. On the other hand, the flip side of that is at a certain point, if you go to them that often, the stock doesn't have that much turnover, so it gets kind of played out. You know, so it's not like you can go there all the time. But I think they have the best selection that I've found of, you know, things like 50-cent bins, dollar bins, quarter bins, things like that. Because if you're going to San Diego, unless you're like really got a big setup or something, it doesn't pay the amount of money that it costs you for a booth. You're not going to make your money back taking up floor space with 50-cent bins for the most part. There might be a couple of people, but you can get just as good of that at the local shows or the regional shows. That kind of stuff is really good. at those kind of shows.
Well, and like you said, it all comes down to how much are the exhibitors paying for their space, and therefore how much money do they need to make back for it to be worth their while. And obviously, the less they're paying for the space, the cheaper the items they can sell. That's something that I've really seen change over the last 20, 25, 30 years or whatever in San Diego. I remember when the dealer's room was nothing but this sea of long boxes, and if you couldn't find the comic there, it's because it didn't exist. You know, you'd go to Mile High, they'd punch your badge and give you a free comic. And then it got to where, you know, fewer and fewer of those kinds of booths were around. And now, I mean, Mile High, they're not even bothering to bring computers sometimes to order from their website. They just have the trades and stuff. It's a completely different experience. Whereas at the local shows, you're still going to find a lot more of those long boxes filled with comics. To me, the more nebulous area is this middle tier, the regional shows. Because it's kind of, you know, what qualifies there, what's big enough to be a national one or not. I mean, like MegaCon, I would say is pretty much a regional show, but it gets enough press and stuff sometimes that it could almost be a small national show.
Yeah, I guess there's two tiers of the regional shows, and Brian, you've been to quite a few of these, but, you know, to me, it's like you get something like a Heroes Con, MegaCon, Wizard World, Philly, you know, things like that. Those are relatively decent size shows, whereas you flip around and you go to something like Wizard World LA is about the same size as this local Frankenstein, but it's got panels and things at it. And, you know, even the Phoenix Con, which I really like, it's very small. The differentiation I make between a local show and a regional show on the small end of the regional shows is if they have guests and panels. A regional show will kind of, by definition, in my opinion, have celebrity guests, you know, creators, and it will also have panel tracks of programming of various things. Whereas the local shows are usually just some dealers selling stuff, and there's not a whole lot else. You know, maybe they'll show a film or something. The Shrine used to do that. It'll have some like Hollywood type in there signing autographs. I don't consider having people in to sign autographs the same thing as when you have like the panel discussions where you can interact with the guests in that way. And that's where you kind of get like the lower tier of regional shows like your Phoenix, your Wizard World LA, you know, things like that, towards the larger ones, you know, like your MegaCon and, you know, Baltimore and, you know, things like that, which are still nice smaller shows. They're not New York, they're not Los Angeles or Chicago, but they're pretty good size.
Right. As far as the middle tier goes, from the ones that I have attended, I would probably have to put the Pittsburgh Comic Con, the Baltimore Comic Con, and Heroes Con sort of in the same general grouping. And Wizard World Philadelphia, the next step above that, but not quite as high as your San Diego and your New York. Now, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and Heroes, they all have some kind of programming. Now, not as extensive as your San Diego's or New York, they do have some programming, and they do also get some of your celebrity guests. But Heroes especially is really geared more towards just selling comics. Baltimore, you do have a mix of some toys as well as Pittsburgh. But I just get a feeling for Heroes, you get a lot more of your back issues. It's more comic-centered at Heroes. But you do still find actually a lot of the same dealers at all three conventions. And again, it runs the gamut from your dollar books, even less than that, quarter books, some of these shows, up to your, you know, high-priced Silver and Golden Age high-grade books. And I found great deals at all three of those conventions. Wizard World Philly, again, I haven't been there since 2006, since I missed it this year because it had the same date as Heroes. But Wizard World Philly, you get more of your media guests, and you have a lot more panels and a lot more creators coming there to sign. You still can find some good deals there, but it's more snazzy than those other three shows.
You're going to find that since these are bigger shows than the local ones, exhibitors getting charged a little bit more, so they're going to be a little bit more selective sometimes in what they're bringing. And sometimes it's just kind of counter-programming mentality. If they think a lot of people are going to have the higher price stuff, they may go in with a quarter bin thinking they can get, you know, more money that way. But you also, at this level, I think, start to get, like you were mentioning, Brian, dealers that go to more than just the one convention, but they'll go to a whole circuit of them.
Right.
And I think at that point, you start getting a different kind of inventory that sort of survives that process.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things that you're more likely to find in a, again, like a dollar bin or something at a local show, because these exhibitors that go to multiple regional shows take the same stock to each of these shows, somebody else is going to have found the, I don't want to say cherry-picked the stock, but it's more likely to be subjected to that.
Right. Now, you mentioned, Bob, that the Wizard World LA is sort of on the smaller scale. So I'm curious, John, with the upcoming Wizard World Texas, have you been there? What can you compare that to?
I've actually never been to that one.
Oh, really? Okay.
For a couple of reasons, either work, weather, or whatever. It's just beyond a day trip is what it comes down to for me.
Okay.
It's an overnight thing, and I haven't really decided if I'm going to go to this year's or not, and I haven't really given it a whole lot of serious thought. But size-wise, it's, I mean, part of it, you also got to realize that my perspective on this is so skewed from having grown up in San Diego.
Yes, you're spoiled, basically.
Oh, totally. I mean, I look at a show like MegaCon or DragonCon, which I think is an excellent convention, but more of a general purpose convention, a lot more sci-fi and stuff, and the comics presence there is comparatively minimal and almost non-existent compared to, say, like a Heroes Con that I've never been to but want to. But I've also been to, I think it was the Philly one, but this would have been back in 96, 97-ish, about the time it was starting.
Okay.
And it was a decent size regional convention, but the problem I had, and it was all my problem, nothing to do with the show, I went in expecting San Diego. I go into a dealer's room that's about the size of the largest panel room in San Diego. I walk the thing in about an hour and a half, and I'm thinking, this is it? So, I mean, you got to go in with the right and realistic expectations.
My opinion is, like, wizard shows in particular, and I'm going to be a little prejudiced here, so kind of go with me for a second here. I find a wizard show to be somewhat of a soulless corporate show. It's very obviously a for-profit show. I really kind of don't like the feel at a wizard show to some extent versus some of the ones that are run by nonprofit fan organizations. And as an example, you know, like Wizard World LA, it's a fraction of the size of the San Diego convention. It's got nowhere near the programming, the guests, or anything like that. The duration of it is pretty much Friday, you know, afternoon, Saturday, and Sunday. And it costs almost more for a ticket to that thing than it does to get into San Diego. And Wizard has this skewed thing that they do where they sell VIP tickets to people.
Yeah.
That let them get in beforehand. And, you know, if you want to buy like convention exclusives or anything, they all get bought up by these people who pay $150 for a VIP ticket. They buy up these exclusives so they can sell them on eBay. And I just get the feeling that I'm at this convention with a lot of people who are only there to, like, you know, do commerce to buy stuff so they can take it away and sell it to people on eBay. Whereas I get more of a fan kind of experience at shows that are run by fans.
One of the best conventions I went to that was not San Diego, which is the majority of my conventioning experience, was the Plano Sci-Fi Convention back in 2001. It was very much a small local show, and I mean, you could see the entire hall from any one spot. You know, it's was it like a community center, and it's a big auditorium with a stage where they had the people who were doing the autographs and stuff, and they had a bunch of people from Star Trek or Babylon 5. Dirk Benedict was there from the A-Team and stuff, and Battlestar Galactica, the original. And it was run by fans. These were people who were interested in the stuff, they were having a good time, and it was the complete opposite of that kind of soulless experience that you described there, Bob. And, I mean, it all comes down to, what are you looking for in a convention? Again, do you want to have that ability to pay the extra hundred and some odd dollars to get that VIP pass, to get in that door first, or do you want to just have a good time? I'm totally against the whole VIP badge mentality. I think that's just bad.
Let's start talking about buying back issues at these cons.
Okay.
So, sure. Brian, you know, when you're going to a convention, what are certain things that you're going to look for as indicators on what makes you want to buy something. I mean, two things that I know is, like, a lot of times you can haggle with the guys, especially if you're buying more than just like one thing. And the other one is, you know, it's kind of rolling the dice, but taking advantage of like the last day discount, you know, and buying stuff on Sunday, you know, after lunchtime, where, you know, the guy might not want to pack it up and haul it away home, and they're going to maybe give you a little better deal on it. Now, that works a little better at the regional or national shows, where the dealer maybe actually had to physically travel to it. For a local show, that's probably not going to, you know, work as well.
Right. My strategy at the conventions is I usually have two things I'm looking for: either older issues to fill my runs for the Silver Age, and then more recent things that I passed up at cover price but looking for a dollar. I usually hit the dollar bins first, just because they're the ones that are going to get picked through the most, and if you get there early, you're going to get the best selection. Now, there's not really room for dealing there, but sometimes they'll say, hey, if you buy 60 books, give them to you for $50. So if you buy them, you know, a lot of the books from dollar books, you might get a deal there. But I'm with you. When I look for the older books, I will usually just walk around, make a note of who has what prices they have marked on it. And then what I will usually do is I will wait towards the end of the day, because, you know, they're looking to get rid of their things, not to take them back with them. And then I will say, hey, you know, how much is this? Because I've gotten a few good deals just by waiting to the last day. So it depends on what you're looking for. Now, I'm looking for lower grade stuff, so a lot of the times they're more flexible with that, because, you know, they have if it's a higher grade, they're not going to make much of a margin, markdown on that, because they know it's a really good grade. But the lower grades, I don't know if there's a great market for them, so they're looking to get rid of that, and that's where I go. So high-end books, I usually wait till the end day and see if I can haggle, but the dollar books, I hit those the first few minutes of the convention.
Yeah, I'm the same way. And lately, with the dollar bin and 50-cent bin books, I generally will avoid dealers who don't have their dollar or 50-cent books at least in some semblance of alphabetic order. You know, at least some dealers, you know, they'll at least have all the A books in one box, you know, and the B books. I mean, they don't have to be exactly in order. I don't like to waste my time on something that's like just totally random mishmash of books, because that just takes so long to kind of go through those. So I'll generally try to avoid those. But I'm in the same boat as you in that I do want to take advantage, because I'm buying down. I don't go down all the way down into good, but I'll usually try to stay around very good, and I can usually get a deal on those. But another thing is I try to be very aware on the list of things that I'm buying of what the guide value is in very good and fine. And you saw that little notebook I had when I was out at the Golden Eagle sale, where I kind of got – did you see that, Brian?
Yeah, that was the Overstreet Wired book.
Basically,
there?
Yeah, it was a little – well, actually, I just have a little notebook that I have the Overstreet prices. I have like the main books that I'm looking for, and I've just got the numbers, you know, maybe a range of numbers, and then I've got the very good and fine price from Overstreet noted down in there, because what I can usually tell is if a dealer is, in general, if I'm looking at their books and I see that most of their books are priced way out of line with Overstreet, I generally don't want to do business with that guy.
Okay.
And I'll move along to the next one. Right. You know, and other people, they're very much in line with what I, you know, I guess there's the guys who price by Overstreet and the guys who price by Wizard. And I try to stay away from the guys who price by Wizard.
Right.
Because those tend to be overinflated, you know, hot market prices.
Yeah, you make a good point about the having the back issues in some semblance of order if they're on the low end of the price scale, because I will most times I'll just, you know, bypass them altogether. But if I find, you know, a bunch of dollar books, they're in a great order, they're in great abundance, I will spend the bulk of my time at that dealer and, you know, ignore everybody else. If I have time, I'll go visit them. But, and then again, with the older books, yeah, you have an idea of the prices your grades that you're looking for are in. Absolutely. And Overstreet is a great resource for that.
Well, yeah, because you want to know how much the stuff is valued at before you pay. Totally. Now, one thing I tend to do when I go looking for back issues at a convention is I try to determine how badly I want that back issue. Because if it's something that I'm just mildly interested in, then I'll certainly, you know, wait till the last minute till, you know, the retailers or exhibitors are trying to figure out, you know, have they made their break-even point or not? Are they willing to haggle or not? But then there's other stuff that, come hell or high water, if I find a copy, I will pay, you know, whatever they want because I don't think I'll see another copy or I want it that badly, whatever. Because nothing is more frustrating than to see that one comic you need to complete your run or you want for whatever reason, go looking around for a better price, say, oh no, I'm not going to find a better price, go back to that exhibitor and they've sold it.
Yep.
You know, so you got to keep that in mind too. But certainly, like you guys are saying, at the national ones, waiting until that last day, you can get some insane bargains.
Yeah, that's a really good point, John. And there's, I guess, a difference between, you know, when you need that one issue left, you know, it's kind of like the one issue left syndrome where I might be willing to pay more for that one issue because it's going to complete my run, or even if I've got two or three issues left. But in general, I have a rule of thumb that I almost never want to buy something the very first place I see it, because Murphy's Law is going to tell me that if I buy it at the very first place that I see it, I'm going to walk around the corner, especially in a big show,
yeah,
and some other dude's going to be selling the same thing for like half as much. And then I just feel ripped off and it ruins my whole day. Whereas, you know, if it's the very last one, like for instance, I've been looking for Captain Marvel number 27, the first series, forever. And I just never see that book. And it only goes for, I don't know, like, you know, $5 or $6 in very good, maybe $7 or something like that in very good condition. If I saw that book and it was like few bucks over, I would buy it just because I never see that and that'll complete that run for me. But in general, if I need a whole bunch of stuff and I know that they're $7 and very good, if somebody's got them for 10, I won't even consider it, because there's a tremendous number of dealers, especially in the lower grades, where you can find a lot of stuff there for even down like Brian, you were mentioning, like half guide price or so.
Oh, sure.
You know, because there's just not as much demand in the lower grades, you know, very good and fine in particular, which are still very solid, you know, lower end collectible books, in my opinion, very solid and complete and, you know, good eye appeal and everything. But you can still get them for decent prices. And in fact, you know, like at the Golden Eagle sale, I mean, I got a lot of stuff there in those lower grades, that very nice stuff. And all of it, because Lem had that stuff priced pretty strictly to Overstreet. So when he had that half off sale, I was getting all that stuff for half guide price, which is a tremendous bargain.
Absolutely.
But what I found is, particularly at conventions, more so than online, although it applies to eBay too, know what your budget is. Don't spend any more than you are happy to spend on that item. Because like you said, Bob, you may go another 20 feet, two aisles over, whatever, and somebody's got it for half the price or a better deal or a better conditioned version of it, whatever. So make sure that when you put your money out there to get whatever, comics and stuff, that you're happy with that deal, at the very least at that time, knowing that you could get a potentially a better deal or not, you know. But I've found, certainly in past years in San Diego, there's a lot to be said for having cash on hand. There's a lot to be said for knowing where the ATM is. And there's even more to be said for knowing how much is in your bank account. I've had at least one year, convention would open at 10 a.m. Thursday, and this was back when I lived there, so I had my car parked underneath the convention center to store everything I was buying. I was in line for that ATM by noon. So, you know what you can afford, and also know what you can carry, because comics get heavy.
Yes.
That's a difference when you, like, have to travel a long distance to go to a show. For instance, like, if you actually have to fly, that was one thing that I allowed for. When I went to the Golden Eagle show, I packed a flat bag, you know, a collapsible bag in my suitcase, so that I could take the stuff I knew I was going to buy there. I could take that bag out, you know, because I just did a carry-on on the way over, and I checked a bag on the way back because I had an extra bag going back.
Yeah, plan ahead for that kind of stuff. It's gotten to where my sister tends to take a poster tube when we go to San Diego and stuff, just for all the posters she's going to pick up there. And I usually take a small comic box, and actually a small magazine box, in the car when we drive to San Diego. That way we've got room for all the magazines, all the programs, all the event guides, all the comics, all the freebies, and all that kind of stuff. It's also a good idea at conventions to be making a list of what you're buying as you buy it. Nothing is more frustrating than getting home, unpacking all your stuff, and realizing you bought two or three copies of that one comic. And maybe that's just my own, you know, chronic amnesia coming into play, and I'm sure you guys don't have that problem.
No, that happened to me, and after that happened, I decided to just take my comic-based list with me and just check it off as I go. Absolutely. You need to keep track, otherwise you're going to just buy the same thing twice. It does happen.
Yeah, and I what I did was I just bought, went down to the local, you know, store, and I bought a little hardcover notebook, a little spiral-bound hardcover notebook that's, you know, pretty small. It's like about 4 inches by 6 inches. I can fit it in my back pocket or, you know, in a pocket of a backpack very easily. And the stuff that I'm most looking for, I just, you know, I spend some time and I jot it down in there. It's not all computerized and stuff, but I find carrying big 8.5 by 11 sheets of printed paper a little more unwieldy. So I like the notebook approach. And just as I get something, I cross it off. And I always look on there. And that keeps me from the duplicate syndrome, which I used to fall prey to myself.
Yeah, I saw your system in action both before and during the San Diego convention, and I was very impressed by it. It's a very simple system, but it works great for you. So I think that's awesome. The other thing is, when you go to these conventions, if you can get a copy of the floor plan ahead of time and a list of exhibitors, do so. Know where the exhibitors you're likely to either want to buy stuff from. Know where places are, because sometimes it's very easy to misplace that exhibitor that you want to go back to because you can't remember the booth number or something like that. I tend to be a little overboard on that, particularly with San Diego, just because of how gargantuan the exhibit hall is there. But as much prep work on that as you can do going in, both in terms of knowing where the exhibitors are, and like you were saying, Bob, prepping the list of what you want to buy and knowing how much the Overstreet guide is for that, well worth the time it takes. We pretty much done on the convention stuff. We got anything else to add on that?
I think we hit it all. What do you think, yeah. Brian?
Yeah. Just to touch on San Diego a bit, it was my first time out there this past year, and I didn't hit the back issue part of the floor until like Friday afternoon. There was just so many other things to do, and I think I ended up buying very few, like less than 10 back issues altogether at San Diego. So for me, that's not the draw of San Diego, although I did find a few deals at that show. The larger conventions tend to differ like that. I go to the Chicago convention, and I found so many back issues there. It was crazy. I found like 100 to 200 back issues there. That con, I just had a great time digging through bins. San Diego was something totally different. So, again, it depends on which convention you go to, what back issues you're going to be able to find.
Well, and also the kind of stuff you're looking for, because I've found San Diego's kind of stratified to where you've got the higher end stuff that's either slab worthy or actually in slabs, the key Silver Age, Golden Age type stuff, or kind of the stuff stores are just trying to blow out, and that there's a definite middle tier of books that used to make up the bulk of what had been available there. It's just not worth the while for a lot of the retailers to bring. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you got to match what you're looking for with the convention you're going to.
And I agree with you, Brian, in that this year at San Diego, I hardly bought any back issues. I mean, I bought a few, but really the draw of that kind of convention is talking to the creators, going to the panels. They do have some, because I collect more than just the comics. I get some of the action figures and statues and things like that. So I like to, you know, get some of the convention exclusives. I like to go to the publisher booths and talk to them. I like to get some of the convention exclusive books from the publishers, and, you know, giveaways and things like that. And to me, there's few of the large cons that offer that kind of stuff. So I like to take advantage of that stuff at those cons more so than the smaller shows that one of the main draws is the back issue. So, you know, I'll tend to get more back issues at those smaller cons.
Yeah. I tend to like San Diego just because it gives me a chance to kind of get a feel for the state of the industry. Are people kind of upbeat? Are people kind of, you know, waiting for the sky to crash down, or what's the mood? But, you know, that's got nothing to do with buying back issues, of course. Or sometimes it does, because sometimes you'll hear, you know, you'll see a lot more money changing hands some years than others. And that says a lot about kind of the general interest level in comics.
Just to go a little bit, I know, Brian, you're like me in that you love getting the sketches and the art, and a big show, you know, that has a lot more opportunities for things like that than a lot of times some of the really small shows, like local shows, have virtually none of that. But maybe the medium-sized shows, you have more access to the sketches and stuff, but some of the original art type of stuff, you might find more at the larger shows. So you can spend a little bit more time doing that kind of stuff at the bigger show, again, because there's more of the creators there.
All right. But that's a whole other show entirely for the original art, Bob, between you and I.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one that I would neither be qualified to talk on, nor sure I'd want to listen to for fear of draining my bank account even further, you know?
Okay, you want to switch over? Let's talk about our actual back issue feature of this episode. We're going to talk about the Batman stories by Steve Englehart. And this run is a very classic run from Detective Comics. Now, we're going to cover Steve Englehart primarily. He started writing in number 469, and he finished up in 476. For the bulk of that run, the artist team on that was Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin, starting in issue 471. And that was a very definitive era of art for those guys. And Marshall Rogers hung around for a couple of issues after Steve Englehart left and Len Wein took over the writing chores in 478 and 479. And there was a little bit of wrap-up to the Silver St. Cloud storyline and some things like that. So we can mention a little bit about that at the end. But basically, there's what I feel to be a little bit of precursor story coming in 469 and 470 when Walt Simonson is doing the art. The meat of this Englehart run is really the Englehart-Rogers stuff from 471 through 476. And then there's almost like an epilogue with the Len Wein and Marshall Rogers on the Clayface story in 478 and 479. Do you kind of agree with that assessment, Brian?
Yeah, that's pretty much spot on there. I had not read these issues in quite some time and didn't realize how the Englehart-Rogers team really only lasted just those six issues.
It is phenomenal when you think of it, because you think back at how fondly you remember it and how just some of the things that happened in that very short span of issues was tremendous, but it was very short, a very short period of time.
And they jammed so much into those issues. I mean, you had the whole Hugo Strange, who hadn't been around for 30-some years, popping back up. Same thing with Deadshot popping back up. And you have that classic Laughing Fish storyline. I mean, this is just great stuff, and it is only really six issues.
It's amazing how much of this stuff was used for not only the Batman animated series, but even some of it for Batman Beyond. Because Dr. Phosphorus was kind of the model they used for one of the villains in Batman Beyond. Shoot, what's his name? I want to say Blight, but I don't think that's right.
Ah, yeah, that's pretty close. I do remember that now, John, you mentioned it.
This is stuff that has had a huge impact on the ongoing Batman, you know, mythology and stuff. And like you said, for it to be such a short, compact run is really kind of surprising.
I found it like really funny, you know, again, like you, Brian, I hadn't read these stories in a really long time. Mm-hmm. And knowing what we now know about things, you know, in the, you know, this day and age, it's like seeing how, you know, like the radiation is treated, you know, like Dr. Phosphorus is radioactive and, mm-hmm. you know, Batman gets these radiation burns on him. Like, he's like shrugging them off. Oh yeah, I got these radiation. Boy, this Geiger counter's going off when I hold it near my burns. You know, it's like, damn, you know, he's got radiation poisoning. You know, and he's just like, oh yeah, you know what the hell? Put some bandages on it and mm-hmm. move on with my business. It's just funny how, you know, they didn't know certain things back in the 70s that, that we know now about these kind of things. And I'm like, kind of like, yikes. But yeah. The Dr. Phosphorus story, I find it interesting. It's the way that they have the characterization is, it's kind of like a nice intermediary period between the really campy days of the 60s and sort of the more darker modern era that happens in the 80s, really, after Crisis. It, for instance, you know, when Alfred and Commissioner Gordon are laid up in the hospital there.
Oh, yeah.
That one. And Alfred's getting out of bed and, like, serving drinks, you know, to to Commissioner Gordon and bringing him food and stuff. And he's like, oh, well, you know, if you're a gentleman's gentleman, you know, you can't just turn that off. And he's, you know, doing that kind of stuff. And I'm like, wow, what a guy, you know.
Well, one of my favorite things was in, I guess, the second issue of this run on page 8. Because this whole thing takes place with Batman based out of the Wayne Foundation building.
Right.
And he's got his whole Batcave down there and stuff, and he's like, you know, this is why I put my new Batcave down here. It's more accessible to the city, not out in the country and stuff. And then he's talking about how he got the penny and the dinosaur and stuff here. It's like, well, Alfred and Robin grumbled a good deal at helping me move all our trophies into town during Robin's last school break, but I suspect they were really pleased to have them here. And I'm thinking, yeah, those three guys moved that huge penny all by themselves, and they fit it into a semi-truck or whatever. It's like, yeah.
That's Acme truck, no less.
Yeah.
That's the same exact page where he's running the Geiger counter over his burns, noticing that they're all radioactive.
It's like, details, details.
And you got Chief O'Hara there giving him the Serepidus call on the next page, which, again, is a kind of a callback to the TV show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It had some fun stuff. It was, I think it was a few issues later where they had, like, the giant typewriter and stuff. It was a more serious take, but not too serious take on, yet still had some of the trappings, like you said, of the earlier era of a bit more camp and whatnot. It was a very interesting kind of juxtaposition of that.
Right.
And of course, in these first issues with Dr. Phosphorus, we introduced a Silver St. Cloud, who eventually discovers Bruce Wayne's identity as Batman, and, you know, after she's already fallen in love with Bruce Wayne. And, you know, I'd forgotten that she was only around pretty much for this storyline. I don't believe you really mentioned her much later in the Batman mythos.
But, you know, everyone knows, well, not everyone, I mean, most people know who Silver St. Cloud is, and it's just such a solid, rememberable character. And it's like this whole thing, as you're reading it all in one shot here, like, I read this whole thing over the course of about, you know, 3 hours or so. Mm-hmm. You know, it moves really fast. It's like, man,
absolutely.
All of a sudden,
yeah.
He's like in love with Silver St. Cloud and all this kind of stuff's going on. It's like, well, geez, you know, it hasn't been that long here. But I guess, you know, it played out over, you know, like 6 or 7 months of real time. And these stories kind of really maybe had a more real time feel to them back in the original presentation.
Right. And I was talking to John before we started that at the time of publication, which is like in the mid-77, Detective was not a monthly book. It came out 8 times a year. So essentially you have almost the storyline taking place over, oh God, like about a year and a half when you go from start to finish. So yeah, I guess it moves quickly for us reading it in one sitting, but probably not so much if you're reading it as it came out in during that time frame.
Yeah, because at that point it would have seemed like Silver had been around for almost forever, because it'd been about a year or whatever.
Right.
But you can really tell to me, you know, like the art when you flip from that last Walt Simonson issue, and, you know, Al Milgram's doing the inks on it, so I don't know if it's completely Walt Simonson's fault, but not some of Walt's stronger work there.
I mean,
he was young at that time, but when you flip from 470 to 471 and in comes the Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin art, like, wow. You know, it's like night and day.
Yeah, some of that I thought was just great, and it really reminds me of Jim Aparo. That kind of a nice, clean, very, I don't want to say simple style, because it's not. It's got the detail and stuff, but there's an elegance to it that I really like.
I mean, Silver St. Cloud, she's beautiful, the way that those guys draw her. I mean, you can see how Batman falls for her. I mean, she is just gorgeous. And you don't even, you know, all the face rendering is very nicely done. I also found the use of sound effects throughout this whole arc, you know, just to kind of skip around a little bit, was really interesting how they did the sound effects, like the issue with the Penguin,
mm-hmm.
where he's got the umbrella going,
Yeah.
The little rotor blades on it, and it's got the zzz kind of noise, the Z's kind of like all around the outside of the arc of the blade.
Well, a lot of that, I think, goes towards the letterer. And there was one issue, and I forget which one it was, I think it was near the end, where the letterer just tossed a couple of things in that I thought were hilarious. See if I can find that real quick. That may have been in the, it's not just the use of the sound effects, but it was the placement of the sound effects.
That's Milt snapping, and he's like an old-time guy, and it's just, they're integrated into the story, like that panel where the Joker comes in. That's like almost to me like the definitive drawing of the Joker ever. It was on page... Page 8 of... what issue was this?
That was the...
The Laughing Fish issue.
Yeah. Go to the previous page to that after you've admired that beautiful piece of art for the Joker, because you're right. That is definitive.
You know, that's 475. Okay, so the page before the Joker comes in.
Page 7, and at the bottom page, they've got the guy having opened the door, and they've got the bam on the door, and the crack, you know, kind of a thing, above the door frame. But they've got this sign to the left of it.
Yep.
Read the sign.
Yep, I read that. I put a post-it there. It says, "Peruse the Pencilography of Marshall Rogers."
Yep.
And if you look on the previous page on the bottom left one, you can see the Inkology of Terry Austin.
Yep. Yep. If you go back to the second page of that story, the second panel.
Yeah.
There you go.
Read the story.
Read the story. Yeah. Read the story of Steve Englehart's.
Yep. And, you know, going back to that lettering, though, like on that panel on page 8 where the Joker comes in, the way they've got his laugh kind of like wielding around him and kind of like going back and forth, you know, some of the letters as you see them as they twist, you're seeing the backside of them and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, so well done.
Well, I mean, that one panel alone is worth the price of admission for the whole run of stuff. It sums up the character. It's incredibly well penciled, and it's so iconic, like you said.
Since we're kind of skipping around here, I find that we're in that same issue, 475. They're on page 12. And Brian, this goes back to a recent episode of your other little show that you do there, where talking about why people don't just rip off Batman's mask when they
yep.
knock. What Joker says that. There is exactly... You know, it's like, I don't want to know who Batman is. If I know who Batman is, then I'm just fighting against some policeman. You know, what fun right. would there be in that?
Yeah, when I read that, I'm thinking, well, that explains sort of, because in that recent JLA issue, we had that same discussion. Why isn't Joker a mask Batman? Well, goes all the way back here. Again, everything back to this run. It's just, it's all here.
He just states straight out. He says, I don't want that secret penetrated ever.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about it, if the Joker were to make, and presumably has, made that known to any of his hoods, they're going to spread the word, who are going to spread the word, etc. And even if the Joker's nowhere to be found, nobody's going to take Batman's mask off, because if Batman doesn't do anything about it, the Joker would. I mean, it's like, you know, when the one guy was asking to the Joker, well, what are you going to do, boss, on the page 10 and 11? He throws him in front of a truck.
That's right. He said, mind your own business, toss. This storyline, the Laughing Fish, this Joker couple of issues here, this is, to me, even more so than the Killing Joke, the definitive Joker story.
Yeah.
Of pretty much all time, right here. And it's right in the, nestled in the middle of this run, and, you know, the Silver St. Cloud, Hugo Strange, Boss Thorn stuff right in here. This is classic stuff.
Yeah, that was the basis. I mean, I don't even know if we've touched on or seen Rupert Thorne in continuity anytime recently. The last I remember him was he was in the animated show.
Yeah, he was in the cartoon. Has he been in the comics? If so, it certainly wasn't memorable.
Right.
Now, John, might be worth mentioning, you read some reprints of this.
Oh, yeah.
That will certainly be much more accessible to any of the listeners who don't have the issues, because these originals by Rogers and Austin are a bit pricey, as one might imagine. I mean, they're old, plus they're very high-quality stuff.
I read the Shadow of the Batman series, issues 1 through 5, all of which had a cover price of $175, and should be pretty easy to find on, like, mycomicshop.com or any of those, or at conventions, even. And these were reprinted back in 1985 and 86. And it's kind of funny because the story, you know, actually starts on the inside front cover of the first issue and continues on to the inside back cover although they have, in most of these issues, a couple of 8-page backup story that has nothing whatsoever to do with this other than having been penciled by Marshall Rogers.
These Joker issues, I just flipped open the Overstreet. They're like $20 in very good, and they go up from there. They're $40 in fine. I mean, they're quite pricey. But picking up that Shadow of the Batman reprint series.
One kind of oddity that Brian and I noticed before we started recording about this reprint series, on Shadow of the Batman number 5, on the inside front cover, they have the cover gallery. And this is the Clayface story that takes place in issue 478 and 479 of Detective Comics. However, the cover they show on the inside front cover of Shadow of the Bat number 5 is for Detective Comics 477. Sort of. It's actually what they wound up using for 478, except for the issue number and the date, instead of being August, says June in this image. But apparently there was some delays. I guess we decided, what was it, the inker?
Yeah, Terry Austin had left at this point, the Detective Comics.
And was replaced by Dick Giordano. So, you know, whoever pulled the cover image to use for this reprint pulled the pre-corrected version or whatever, which is just kind of funny.
So these are about $3 each in near mint condition, but unfortunately, not in stock right now. The issue 4 is the one with the Joker story in it.
Yeah.
And that one's not in stock because I think people have tumbled to the fact that that's the one to get. But that's one that, you know, if you ever see that one kicking around, that's absolutely one to pick up.
Well, and you know, it's funny because with them doing the hardcover of The Killing Joke, this seems like it would have been a great 2-issue story to toss in that hardcover.
Yeah, that's true. Now, actually, they do have a trade paperback that reprints this entire run. It's called Strange Apparitions. That can be had for $13, and that's got 10 issues. So for, you know, essentially about a little over $1 an issue, you can get the entire run of this in one single trade paperback.
And it's well worth doing that. It had some great stuff. I liked the Deadshot storyline.
I was going to say, again, rereading this, I hadn't realized that at this time in 1977, you hadn't seen Deadshot since Batman 59 was, I think, his last appearance. And he was in a totally different outfit back then. So
yeah,
this was
like
great.
A top hat.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah. He's like a tuxedo-wearing cowboy guy.
Yeah. This was great for the historical value alone, just, you know, to learn that. And so, again, these are just great issues. I can't get over how much they chalked into this short run here.
What this reminds me, just like most of these stories that we've been revisiting on these segments, these back issue shows from the books back in the 70s, is the footnotes, which you don't really see anymore.
Yeah.
Like when Hugo Strange was reintroduced. Professor Hugo Strange, I thought you were dead since all the way back in Detective number 46, no less. And then he says, but I should have known better. You're always one for miraculous returns, and you've turned men into monsters before. Batman number 1, right? And this is, by the way, Batman and the Monster Men series that Matt Wagner recently did in the last couple of years, that was an expansion on the Hugo Strange and the Monster Men storyline that was in Batman number 1. But just reading these two panels, I went over, since I have access to these kind of things, I went over to my Batman archives. And I pulled out, you know, the Dark Knight Archives Volume 1, which, of course, has Batman number 1 in it. And I reread the Hugo Strange story from there. And, of course, Hugo Strange is in there, and he's turning guys into the big giant monsters, much like we see in this story. And, you know, Batman defeats him in about 8 pages here. And, you know, Batman was pretty violent there. He's like going around his bat plane, like mowing people down with the machine guns and stuff. But that was the kind of stuff he did back then. That was 1940, you know. But then also I got clued into those other ones, right? So I went to my Batman Archives Volume 1, and that has both Detective 36, which is the first appearance of Hugo Strange, as well as Detective 46 from February and December of 1940. Those are the other two Hugo Strange stories. I read both of those so that I had like a complete, you know, run of Hugo Strange stories there. And, you know, in the last appearance in Detective 46, he's fighting Hugo Strange, and at the end of the story, he's like fighting him up on a cliff, And Hugo standing on the edge of the cliff, and Batman lays a haymaker on the poor guy, and he goes falling off the cliff down into the river below, and you know they never find the body. But Hugo's back in these stories here, and he explains that he survived and was over in Europe and such. But you know that's where we come back. You know, it's like we got these at the time. I mean, so Hugo Strange had appeared in three stories, all within the scope between February and December of 1940. And had not been seen since then until this story in 1977. And Steve Englehart, you know, kind of dredged that up. And the same thing with Deadshot, you know, had not been seen in 30 some odd years since that one story that he was in back in Batman. And, you know, he brought him back also. And absolutely looking at Deadshot and, you know, the uniform, and he's a very major villain in the DC universe right now. And you can trace that all back to him getting put into these stories right here, because if Steve Englehart had not done that, would somebody else have found this obscure tuxedo wearing bad guy with a couple of six shooters from back in the 50s or, you know, 40s of Batman and done anything with him?
Well, I appreciated just the cameo appearance by Wonder Girl and the footnote referencing Teen Titans 53, because that gave me, it's like, okay, this is where all this takes place in Robin's history. It's cool that they reference the past stuff, and they, like you said, they dig up some stuff that, again, with like what you were saying with Deadshot, if he wasn't in this issue, that would have changed everything with the Suicide Squad that happened. You know, the ripple effect is just incredible.
And just little throwaway things, like seeing Batman and Robin just kind of horse playing around in the Batcave and, you know, kind of...
I loved that sequence.
Play fighting and things, and, you know, you don't see that kind of stuff, and it's like, you know, Batman needs to chill out again and get back. He needs, you know, basically, I don't know, get really crude, but he needs a girlfriend again, you know? It's like, I think the guy's just very tense lately, and that's why he's such a jerk a lot. You know, he's here, he's seeing Silver St. Cloud, and he's just in a really good mood throughout these stories. and then the issue right after this is over, you know, the Len Wein issue, it's kind of like, well, Silver's gone, and he's just wailing the tar out of bad guys, and, you know, that pretty much sets the scene for how he acted for a really long time.
Yeah.
There was a lot of other little neat things you might not have caught reading the issues, that you catch all of the Batman references to, like, Jerry Robinson, you know, Finger Alley.
Yeah, I caught some of those.
Brang, they had
right.
That.
That was really cool to see that.
With that giant typewriter in the one thing, the keys, they're on the typewriter, and Batman is, I forget which one's which. Let me try to find the page here.
I think it's on page 15.
Yep. Yeah.
So Batman's got his foot on the D key, and Deadshot's got his foot on the C key, and it types DC up on the thing. And they've got their foot on the right key. And it's, yep. Weisinger is the, you know, Weisinger office supplies, mm-hmm. is the convention, you know, which is a nod back to Mort Weisinger.
Of course, I'm still wondering how they got that exclamation mark a few characters later, but...
Silver St. Cloud's pretty good if she can get, like, this 50-foot high functioning typewriter set up for...
Well, actually, she didn't. This was the first time her people did all this stuff without her, I think.
No, she's saying this is the first time she's run one of these herself.
This is the first job they've done without my supervision. Page 9, panel 2. Because I thought it was funny. She wants to show Bruce all the work she's done, and she takes him to a place where she hasn't done much of anything. It's kind of funny.
It was also neat. I was reading through some of the letter columns at the time here, and even back then, a lot of the people were catching on. Hey, this is a great team, Englehart and Rogers. They were just, if I can find it, there was one where they were comparing, like, the greatest ever. I mean, so the fans were really catching on to this stuff even back then, you know, and that's another reason why I miss letter columns right now in comics. I mean, yeah, we have the online community, but it's really fun to see this stuff in print here.
Well, and to see it in print hooked to the comics, because, I mean, it's so disconnected online.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 30 years from now, when you go back and reread a comic from today, you are not going to see some forum post about it, you know, right there when you're rereading the story.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. I would be happy if they would just, you know, take some forum posts from the DC forums or whatever and use those as the letter pages, reprint some in there, you know, so at least you can tie commentary to the issues because it does give a certain historical context to the stories.
Yeah. It's one thing, like you said, Brian, for us to be appreciating it now, but the fact that people were kind of picking up at the time that, hey, this is a really good run that we're having right now. I mean, that says a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I really got to say that the team kind of gelled the best on that Joker story, which was really the culmination of their kind of six-issue arc or whatever. I mean, it's too bad they didn't keep going for another, you know, couple of years or something.
Yeah, I guess we did get, what was it, Batman Dark Detective a couple of years ago where they, did they team up again, the whole Rogers?
They did. Engelhart? It was Rogers, Austin, Engelhart, and Silver St. Cloud came back for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Forgot about that.
But yeah, I'm just so impressed. Again, I keep saying this over and over again, but just a short run, how much stuff was in these issues and how it still resonates to some extent today.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that's interesting about kind of the pacing of the stories is there are things that are set up in one issue to pay off in later ones, you know, where we see Penguin in one issue and he's going to be the main villain in the next. We see the Joker in the background because he's going to be in, you know, the next or whatever. And it's not even foreshadowing, but kind of teasing where the story is going to go. And there's no kind of clean the end moment. I mean, each issue has its full story and its sense of closure, but it also has something to push you into that next issue. Although I guess the end of the Joker storyline has kind of that end moment. It just seems like all too many comics these days are either, you know, part X of Y, or, you know, if they're that last part, there's a very much a the end, thanks for coming, and don't bother coming back for the next issue feeling.
You know, the end of the Joker story is that was Steve Englehart's last issue, so I think he wrote that closing scene there, which was his,
yeah,
that was his exit from the title.
And it was also nice you had through the one thread through the issues towards the end was you had Hugo Strange keep popping up as an apparition. And that page, it looks like it's page 9 of what's 476, where Rupert Thorne's driving along the road and you see the ghost just come into. That is just a great sequence. That's just great storytelling. How you see him driving the road, and, oh, there's a ghost hitchhiking, and oh, here he comes.
I really like, Hugo Strange as a villain, and it's funny that I had, before they started using him again recently, I mean, I still had memories of Hugo Strange as being this, you know, bad guy, but I mean, three issues in 1940, you know, maybe six issues here, and that was it for like another 20-some-odd years. But the character just stuck. And in fact, you know, talking about the speed, you know, you look there on that first issue of the Rogers run where Bruce is in that clinic, right? And you got Dr. Todd Hunter. And all the way there near the end, he's ripping off the mask. And it's like, you know, Professor Hugo Strange. And then like within three pages, he has knocked Batman out, which is not that easy to do. Could have let him die, but he didn't. He gives him the antidote and has ripped his mask off and knows that he's Bruce Wayne. You know, it's like, whoa. You know, it's like he hadn't seen that happen. It's like three pages and he's got Batman incapacitated and he's got his mask off.
Now, one thing I do want to point out, just because there's, you know, a lot of talk lately on how late comics are these days. The main stories for all of these issues ran 17 pages.
Yes.
Now, they're a really good 17 pages. I would say arguably better than a lot of what we're getting in the 21 or whatever we're getting these days. But, you know, that's enough pages shorter that it had to make getting the deadlines done a bit easier.
And it's odd. With the very last issue, 479, the price went from 35 cents to 50 cents with 479. And actually, there's a full page in here. It looks like Jeanette Kahn sort of explains the increase there. So even back then, they're concerned about people losing readers because of the prices. You know, it's just compared to what today is. You know, we're at a point right now. How much further do you go? They were conscious of that even back in the 70s as well.
It goes even further than that. There was a thing when they went to 12 cents.
Yeah.
Kind of apologizing for the price increase.
I actually have issue Detective 300. There's an inside cover to talk about that same thing. So it's constantly going on again, the price increase.
Well, the difference is back then they used to be respectful and apologetic about it. And now you got Joe Quesada just being kind of an ass about the whole thing, you know? So there's a definite difference there. So thumbs up on this story arc, everyone?
Oh, absolutely.
I would say definitely so. I certainly think that the Marshall Rogers art was much better than the Walt Simonson stuff. Overall, I thought it was excellent, and the Joker storyline just, you know, raises that even a step above.
I would go so far as to say anyone who calls themselves a Batman fan owes it to themselves to get a hold of this arc and read it.
Yeah.
And anyone who is a Joker fan, if they have never read those two issues, the Laughing Fish issues there, they have to read those two issues. You cannot be a Joker fan and not read those two issues.
Yeah. I was so glad you guys decided to go with something like this, because it gave me the excuse to dig my back issues out of my room here. And it was, I had to do a lot of digging, but it was so worth it to get these stories, because I knew they were in here somewhere. And yeah, just a great read.
Now, how big is your collection?
It's on the upside of 15,000 actual comic issues.
Okay, that's pretty good size.
Yeah.
You're more of a DC guy, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm almost strictly a DC guy. But I've gotten so much with the amassing the collection, I haven't had a chance to stop and read a lot of the issues, so it's great to actually go back and read some of the issues I've collected, because otherwise they're just, you know, sitting here, so I'm glad I actually dive into them. I needed a good excuse to go do that.
Well, anytime you want to discuss another DC run or whatever, I'm a huge DC fan myself, and as long as Bob and I either have the issues, can get the issues, or somehow, you know, read them, you're certainly welcome back anytime.
Yeah, I gotta go dig through the archives again for some good stuff.
Particularly stuff that has been put into trades or reprints or, you know, archives or showcases. You know, if they're that way, even if we don't have all the original ones, if we can relatively easily get a hold of the, you know, issues, then that's something that we can easily do a spotlight show on. And I'm so glad that I have so many of my archives and stuff, because I found it was just cool that, you know, they had these footnotes to issues of Batman and Detective from the 40s. And I'm like, oh, well, I'll just walk over to the shelf there and
yeah,
pluck that archive off. And, you know, I certainly don't have the original Batman issues from then, but it was cool to be able to pick off and read all three of those original Hugo Strange stories.
No, that is cool. That is cool.
Which those should actually be in, you know, some of those, if you get like those Chronicle ones that are in color. This was pretty close to the beginning of the Batman run, so.
I've got the Chronicles. I might even have the archives. I need to inventory my hardbacks and trades, because I haven't done that for my older run of those.
Yeah, like the Batman archives actually reprints Detective Comics, and the Dark Knight archive reprints Batman title, right?
Well, that makes sense.
Because Detective came first anyway. Since Detective Comics, you know, back in the day, I mean, it was like a 64-page magazine, but it only had like an 8-page Batman story in each issue, you know, and the rest was, you know, like Slam Bradley or, you know, Dr. Occult or, you know, things like that. So the first volume of the Batman archives actually has all the Batman stories from Detective 27 through 50. You know, you got over 20 issues of Batman stories in there, and they just go through it a fairly fast clip. Whereas when Batman actually came out as his own magazine, I mean, that was all Batman, right? So there's only the first Dark Knight archive only got 4 issues of Batman in it, but, you know, it's 200 pages.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I think that more or less wraps us up, unless you, either of you, have anything you want to either announce or talk about or whatever.
No, just thank you very much for having me on the show. I really had a good time. It's great talking with you guys again.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you were able to get your hands on that Batwoman sketch.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Bob is being my enabler, as I enable him sometimes.
I do that.
Located a Sheldon Moldoff Batwoman sketch for me out. Actually, not too far from where you are, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's about a 45-minute drive.
Yeah. So thank you. That's actually, I already paid for it, so I should be seeing it soon.
Cool.
And if you can indulge me a quick plug, we have an episode coming up of our little dog and pony show, Comic Geek Speak 326. I was surprised they gave a roast for me. So that was a really, really fun episode. If you get a chance to 326, they roast me. Quite to my surprise. I had no idea it was coming.
Cool.
I will definitely listen to that one. Is that going to get Flint Lockjaw and the Order of the Pants Society all up in arms?
I'm sure he'll be worked up about it. Just a caution that it is not suitable for work.
I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
By the time this show goes up, it should be up on our feed, I would imagine.
Oh, it should definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys put them up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll probably take me maybe a week or so to get this edited. I've still got one or two in the pipeline before it.
Wow.
Try to get it up before the next time they record. That way Brian can give this show a mention.
Absolutely.
So you can mention this show and have people who are your legions of fans come over and check it out.
I don't know about legions of fans, but thank you very much. I'll absolutely mention it.
Cool.
Because this was a blast. I had a great time. My first adventure into Skyping.
So now although a lot of times we do them, you guys all have game night on Fridays, huh?
Yes, we do.
That's when we do the preview thing. Although, now that you have Skype and you got a microphone, the next thing you do is go and find a program called Audacity.
Okay.
It's free, and you can record MP3 files very simply. What we're also doing, a preview cast that lets people, just general people, go on and give a shout out to whatever book interests them and kind of give a little sales pitch. And then we kind of weave those together. And we're going to do that on a monthly basis now.
Oh, very cool.
So people can record their little clip. And I had a little contest going for everyone who sent in to get the ball rolling. I gave out a prize of that Indie Spinner Rack Awesome Anthology. And,
oh, very cool.
And Raph Wraithmaker, he won.
So uh-huh.
I mailed that off to him today.
This holiday season, the Comics Podcast Network is proud to partner with the Hero Initiative to sponsor the Heroes for the Holidays Fund Drive. The Hero Initiative creates a financial safety net for yesterday's creators who may need emergency medical aid, financial support for the essentials of life, and an avenue back into paying work. Hero gives all comic fans the ability to thank and support the wonderful comic writers, pencilers, inkers, colorists, and letterers who have created some of our favorite comic book stories. The Comic Podcast Network encourages our listeners and fellow comic book fans to remember the Hero Initiative during this holiday season and to consider making a donation to this organization. You can be a hero for the holidays by visiting www.comicspodcast.com/hero to find out how to donate to the Hero Initiative, or you can go directly to Hero by visiting www.heroinitiative.org for more information on this great organization. Thank you, and have a wonderful holiday season.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.